Join us this week as we descend into the darker side of human nature and uncover the shadows that dwell in the unknown. From chilling true crime and gruesome murders to spine-tingling paranormal encounters that defy explanation, we're peeling back the curtain on things that go bump in the night. So grab a flashlight and maybe a blanket, because you're listening to The Guilty and the Ghostly. Welcome back, GGP.
Episode 40.
Yep.
Welcome back.
Back from their trip.
Yeah, how was your New York trip?
It was very fun. Not as cold as I actually thought it was going to be.
I know. It was only a couple of degrees colder there than it was here that week.
Yeah, we brought layers upon layers, so we were pretty warm.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people. I don't think I'm ever going to listen to the Empire State song ever again.
You're over it.
Yeah. I'm over it. Because there's these little guys on bicycles driving around playing it.
Really?
The whole time we were there.
Did you see any cool things, spooky? Did you do any spooky?
We saw this, it was an old church. It looked pretty scary, but I didn't get a good picture of it.
Yeah.
So it was raining when we saw it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why it looks scary, but.
Sounds like the werewolves are awake.
Yeah. Charlie's back. Well, we have a long episode today, and so I guess we can just go ahead and get into it, because I don't have any business. I don't have any updates. You guys have anything?
Did y'all already share the winner?
Yeah, you want to do it again?
Yeah, Avery Mizzles is the winner.
She won. Kitty girl.
Yay.
Congratulations.
And we want to do another giveaway soon, I think.
Yeah, we'll figure out what it is.
In the works.
Yep. And I made a new shirt that I'm wearing. You can't really see it, but.
Super cute. New logo for the shirt.
Yeah. Yep. So with you coming back from New York, I wanted to look up a case for New York. And I think I already told you this. I know I mentioned it last week, but after I finished research on last week's episode, I was just kind of scrolling through Hulu. I just kind of wanted to watch a quick documentary that was just kind of a one-off. I really didn't want to deep dive. And I found this one, and I was like, I'm not very familiar with it. And it was only 2 episodes. I was like, easy. Then I started watching. And then I started researching. And now we have our second two-parter episode. So much for a quick and easy one. And it just so happened to be New York and New Jersey.
So I'm happy you're telling me this story once I got back, not before I went.
I almost did it before you went, but then I was scared I would scare myself. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be freaking out. So I'm glad I didn't do the deep dive until after you got back, because be ready to be enraged, to be absolutely enraged by a deplorable human being. This, you hear serial killers and Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer and the big ones. I don't know if it's just because he hasn't been on my radar, but I hadn't heard much of this one. And then once I started researching the case, I was just like, how is this not a bigger known case? And so today we are going to cover the Torso Killer. His name was Richard Conyngham. And I got a lot of my information, and a lot of this is from that documentary I found on Hulu, and it's actually called The Torso Killer Confessions. Very good documentary, very well made. I'm setting it up how the documentary did, to where you get it from the detective's point of view and him trying to find out information on this, and it'll make more sense here in a little bit. I feel like a lot of times cops get a bad rap. They don't do their job. They don't do the investigating they need to. They drop the ball. This guy, he inherited this case after it was all said and done, and this guy was already in prison. So he's trying to solve cold cases. And the amount of work and the care that you can tell that he gives to these victims and their families, I think, needs to be known. And to remember that not all cops, not all investigators, not all detectives are shitty humans. A lot of them do take pride in their job. They do want to bring answers to these families, and they do want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Here we go.
Okay.
I'm not kidding. I was like irate when I was doing this. Irate. A new detective on the homicide squad of New Jersey named Robert Anzalotti was assigned a series of cold cases in the year 2000. The majority of them happened between 1965 to 1974. So almost a 10-year span. He is given all the evidence from the murders. He said that when he got the evidence, it was just boxes upon boxes full of evidence, case files, clothing, pictures. Just he said it was almost overwhelming getting all of the information to start going through to solve these cold cases. He also mentioned that it would basically ignite a fire in him that he didn't even know existed as he started going through all these cases. There were 12 cases total. Most of them were girls that were last seen with a stranger or hitchhiking, because that was normal back in the day, 1960s, 1970s. You just hitchhike where you go. It was just normal. They would be found. Oh, and here's another thing. I think we need to give a huge trigger warning to... What the hell is that?
That was the trigger
warning. That was the trigger warning. I don't know if this picks it up, but oh my gosh. A huge trigger warning for rape, sexual assault, basically anything and everything is in this case. So just, if that's not what you're into, you can't handle it, maybe skip this one for now. It's dark. Most of the girls were last seen with the stranger hitchhiking. They would be found raped, murdered around the northern part of New Jersey in what's called Bergen County, across the Hudson River from New York City. It had a profound effect on the community and caused everyone to be suspicious of everyone, not knowing who was doing it, because these bodies just kept showing up and they had no leads on who was doing it. There was a wide range in ages, from early teens to late 20s. No one was safe, and everyone was on edge. There were several main suspects. Convicted rapist named Raymond Alves claimed to have killed 15 women. Robert Reldon, a former honor student who had been involved in numerous rapes. Joe Callinger, known as the Shoemaker Killer. He would actually use a knife in his murder spree across the state, and then his last killing was in Bergen County, and he had killed a nurse. So they had several suspects to pick from. Thinking they had something to do with these cases. Detective Anzalotti investigated each one and flew all over the country, chasing leads, all going nowhere, except for one. Only one name that kept coming up and he could not eliminate, and his name was Richard Cottingham. Richard Cottingham had been convicted for the murder of five women. Three of the women were in New York City and two in Bergen County. He got the nickname of the Torso Killer after the murders in Times Square by the New York media. The women were found with their heads and hands cut off, and the room that they were in was lit on fire. Cottingham would be caught after attempting to rape a sex worker in Bergen County at a local Jersey motel on May 22, 1980. The 12 cold cases that Detective Anzalotti was investigating were all centered around that same area. While Cottingham was in prison, detectives began to talk to him about unsolved murders in the area. Unfortunately, nothing ever became of it. He was obviously committing these crimes in the 80s, and with his age, it very well meant that he could have had to do with the crimes in the 60s and 70s as well. That's when Detective Anzalotti knew he had to at least try to talk to Cottingham about the 12 cases he was working on. Knowing that other detectives had tried to talking to Cottingham before, but they had no success. Detective Anzalotti had to rethink of ways to get Cottingham to talk. And that's another thing that in this case with this killer is... it's a cat and mouse game to him. Like, he's still playing games even behind bars, and you'll see that here in a little bit. Not only was Ancelotti investigating the 12 cold cases, but he had numerous other cases he was working at the same time that involved mob hits that led him to Richard the Iceman Kolinsky. Kolinsky was known to brag about killings he had done for the mob. He had gotten the nickname the Iceman because he was known to put the bodies in the freezer after killing them to try and change the temperature of the body to throw off the time of death and investigators. So he would just, after he'd kill him, he'd shove him in a freezer to try to throw everybody off.
What the heck?
Wow.
And was that the same guy?
No, this is a different guy. This okay. is the Iceman. And you'll see what I'm talking about him in a minute. Kolinsky was a huge 6'8" guy with a foreboding presence and a short temper. Ancelotti had built a rapport with Kolinsky after interviewing him numerous times trying to get more information about his killings. So the detective had investigated Iceman before and had interviewed him, and they kind of had relationships, not the right word, but kind of a relationship, a rapport with each other. After building trust with Kolinsky, Detective Ancelotti was able to get enough information and closed numerous other cold cases. Ancelotti thought this was the perfect opportunity to see if he could use Kolinsky to get more information about Cunningham, because Cunningham and Kolinsky were held in the same prison and on the same wing. He's like, here's my inside information. This guy will help me. So Ancelotti talked to Kolinsky, these names, man, they're cool. But I know I'm going to trip up. Ancelotti talked to Kolinsky and asked if he knew anything about Cunningham. Kolinsky told the detective, "I hate that scumbag. What kind of animal does those types of things to women?" So Cunningham, the torso killer, he wasn't even liked by other prisoners. Like, he is such a narcissist that even other killers were like, F him. I don't want nothing to do with him.
Dang.
Kolinsky began working with the detective and giving him inside information about Cunningham. That's when they found out that Cunningham was running an illegal gambling operation in the prison. So I guess I need to explain that a little bit better. Right now, Cunningham is already in jail. He has already been arrested for the 5 murders that I briefly covered a second ago. We will go into details with those in a minute. But right now, we're going into where Detective Ancelotti gets the cold cases, and he's going back and reviewing other suspects to see if he can pin it on whoever it is. The detective knew that this was leverage that he needed to use against Cunningham. In 2004, it was a big Super Bowl week, and Detective Ancelotti knew that was prime time for illegal gambling. He knew they were going to be betting on the Super Bowl. So he worked with the prison, and he actually came up with a plan with the prison to raid Cunningham's cell during this week, knowing he was going to have
bets played.
Yeah, all this evidence against him. So the morning after Super Bowl Sunday, they raided his cell and found all kinds of contraband, and Cunningham was thrown into solitary confinement. The hole.
Mm-hmm. Good for him.
You get no yard time. Living conditions were harsh, and it was not a fun place to be.
Don't you get no sunlight, too?
No sunlight. No, you basically get let out for like 30 minutes to eat, shower, and you go right back in.
And normally it's like a 23 hours in and 1 hour out.
Yeah.
If he was arrested for killing 5 people at that point, he should have already been in there.
Yeah. And just wait till you find out what he did, just to those 5 women alone. Wait till you find out. Detective Ancelotti let him sit in there for a few days before going to interview him. He's like, let him stew. Let him sit there. Let him stew. The detective walks in and can tell that Cunningham is absolutely miserable. So Cunningham, he's about 60 years old at this point. And the detective even described him as looking as like a Santa Claus with a really bad hangover. And he does. I mean, he's got a big, white, bushy beard, white hair, big belly. He looked like he described it the best, like a bad Santa. But he actually looked like Santa. He sits down with him and says, "I'm the reason that you've been in the hole." Automatically, he's like, "I did that, motherfucker." Cunningham looked at him kind of crazy. He was like, what the hell? And Detective Ancelotti told him he was going to make his life a living hell unless he has a conversation with him. Right off the bat, he's like, you're playing by my rules, buddy.
Good for him.
They started talking, and Cunningham would not confess anything or give any other information. He would only agree to continue the conversation if the detective didn't continue to mess with him. He's like, leave me alone, and I'll talk. I'll talk with you. Get me out of the hole, then we'll talk. Detective Ancelotti knew after interviewing him that, like, the bad cop routine wasn't getting anywhere with him. He's like, that's not working. This guy's a narcissist. He needs to be put on a pedestal and told he's, like, this amazing, superior human being. He's like, all right, I'll play your game. He began visiting with Cunningham at the prison on a regular basis. The detective had no clue what crimes Cunningham was connected with, but wanted to try to get answers. Cunningham was playing hardball and would not give him any new information. But the detective kept coming back, working on Cunningham, slowly chipping away at him, and slowly Cunningham began opening up about the crimes that he had already been convicted for. So it's, even though it's not about his cold cases, he can tell he's making progress. He's at least talking about the cases that he was convicted of. Because before he wouldn't even do that. He pled not guilty to the ones that he was charged with, and, like, he's literally caught red-handed. We're fixing to get into it, but he's like, he wouldn't even say it wasn't me. He just was like, not guilty.
Yeah.
Before Cunningham was arrested, he went on a murderous spree for a few weeks, targeting sex workers. And that is another thing. I tried to be very mindful on, I know it's not PC to call them prostitutes. I am trying to be very respectful, but this, you can tell that these are an older generation of cops in the documentary, so they don't always use the right terminology.
And I but, hate that, because they're also victims in this stance.
But you can tell that they do care, that they did care about them, and they were, it's just, I don't think they're not up to par, I guess, on using the correct terminology. So I tried to, I might slip up here and there, but, and if I do refer to them as prostitutes, it's because I'm quoting what they were saying.
Okay.
He would go on to say that just by talking to them, he could get them to do whatever he wanted and then get them to go to places they normally wouldn't go. So he's like, I can make them do whatever I want.
He manipulated them.
Yeah.
Probably just with money. I mean, how old was he when he was doing these crimes, does it say?
I'd have to go back and see. All ages, though. All ages throughout his whole life.
Starting when he was a teenager?
I'm not that far yet. I'm still researching the second half. And so in part two, we are going to be covering more of the cold cases. This part, we're mainly covering the ones that he's been convicted of.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and take it back to the crime that he originally got arrested and put in prison for. New Jersey, on May 22nd, 1980, a call comes in reporting a woman screaming in a room at the Quality Inn with a Do Not Disturb sign hanging on the door. A police officer pulls up to the scene and he sees a man, like, frantically waving him down, saying there's a man up there with a gun. So the officer enters the lobby and he's kind of like peeking down the hall towards where the room is that these reports are coming from. And when he does that, he sees a man coming out of a room and like running at him, holding a bag and a gun in one hand. So he steps from around the hall, raises his gun and says like, stop where you are or whatever, the police. And he said that guy like came to a halt, like literally just inches from his gun. And he's like, if he would have moved a finger, I would have pulled the trigger. Like, they were on high alert. The man immediately drops the gun in the bag once he stops. And he immediately says, and this is part of me, I'm quoting, this is not my words, me quoting. And he says, it wasn't me. I was just in there with a hooker. I didn't do anything.
Oh my gosh. So they have no idea what actually happened, but he does have a gun.
He does have a gun, and he just left the room where the girl was in there screaming. This man was Richard Cunningham that left the room. In the room was a young female identified as Leslie Odell. She was naked and handcuffed. She had handcuffs around her ankles. She would go on to say that she was a sex worker. She met the man in New York, and he had taken her to the hotel under the premise that he was going to basically pay her enough money for this one encounter that she would be able to get out of the sex work industry. So kind of that, like you were saying, manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Once they entered the hotel room, things escalated very quickly. Cunningham began torturing Leslie, tied her up to keep her from leaving. He put tape over her mouth and began slicing and cutting all over her breast, her stomach, just slicing her body. He burned her with cigarettes. He sodomized her, and he told her that he wanted, I'm fixing to assault your ears. He wanted a tongue bath, meaning she basically had to lick him head to toe. But in order to do that, he would have to remove the tape from her mouth. And she's like, I'm not going to scream, I promise. He takes the tape off her mouth, and she immediately starts screaming. She's like, this is my one chance to get the hell out of here. She just starts screaming her head off. Someone hears this, and so one person's calling the cops while the other one's knocking on the door saying, hey, everything okay in there? And he forces Leslie Odell to answer the door while he's standing behind her with a knife to her back, making her convince the people, oh, we're fine, everything's good. Well, when they called the police, there was a patrolman literally just right down the street. So he was able to get there within minutes. And that's the one that stopped him in the hall. So luckily, he was right there when they called. Otherwise, he would have gotten away. He would have gotten away.
And did it say how old he was when he committed this one? I know you said 1980. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look. I don't remember.
When was he born?
Let's look real quick.
I'm just trying to figure out, how does someone get, this mental? Does it start early on?
I'm sure.
I'm going to talk a little bit about his childhood. And with serial killers, normally they kind of have a rough upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. He had he was fine. All accounts, perfectly normal.
So he's just...
He was just messed up.
Bleeped up, man.
He was born in 1946.
So he'd have been 40?
40s. Yep. After his arrest, they began searching his belongings. They found whiskey, drugs, and sexual torture devices in his bag. After finding Leslie Odell, they realized pretty quickly there was a lot of similarities of other unsolved cases in the area. So they start questioning Cunningham to see if they could connect him to some of those other cases. He would refer to his killings as huntings and stated that it was always simple and never messy. He would normally just strangle or put bags over their heads and just leave them on the side of the road. He would never shoot them. He then goes on to say that this irritated me. He said, I have had a few strange ones, and then he kind of chuckles about it. He's like, I've had a few strange ones, but we're not going to talk about those. And they're like, pump the brakes. What? what do you mean?
Yeah, what?
Yeah. So they begin to look into Cunningham's life. He had a wife. He had 3 kids. And he worked in the computer division of Blue Cross and Blue Shield in New York. In New York. So a wife and 3 kids.
Was his wife in on it?
No.
Okay.
We'll talk more about his wife in a little while. Ready for an interesting fact? Richard Cunningham and Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer, both worked in that Blue Cross and Blue Shield office at the same time.
Wow.
There is no evidence that they knew each other. They both were using aliases while working there. Because they kind of wondered, did they work together for a while? But no, they didn't even know.
That's insane.
Yeah. Two serial killers working in your office. That is insane.
Yeah.
I could go to brunch with them one day.
Yeah.
and not even know who you're sitting across from? Mm-hmm.
Two of them. let's see here. Cottingham was known to be a very intelligent man, but he was known to be manipulative. His parents seemed to be very normal. He had a good upbringing. They came from a Catholic background. Like, everything seemed completely kosher, completely normal. He didn't seem to have that typical serial killer upbringing. Cottingham would go on to say that he didn't enjoy killing his victims, and if he killed them, it was only because there was something that would link him back to them. And he said that could be something like somebody saw him with them, or like anything at all, and he would be like, nope, it'll connect me, so I've got to get rid of him. He said, quote, "It was a matter of my safety. That's all it was. It wasn't that I enjoyed it," end quote. So I'm so glad you're concerned with your safety and you can take the lives of women because you're worried about you.
Well, I guess that didn't even end up working out because he's in jail, right?
Yep.
Like what?
He was trying to make it seem like he was some kind of superior killer and that he didn't fit the mold of other regular serial killers. He would go on to talk about the sex workers as if they were inferior to him and they would just do whatever he told them to do. Like the entire time they were questioning him, he just kept saying, "Well, I do this, but other serial killers do that. And so I'm not like them. I'm different. I'm better." Continuously through this detective ends up interviewing him for over 10 years trying to get information. And through those whole 10 years, he just constantly was like, "I'm better. I do it this way. I wasn't going to get caught by the police." He blames his wife for getting caught. Like, we'll talk about it in a minute. He blames his wife for getting caught. It's insane. Police then started connecting the dots and wondered if Cottingham could also be connected to murders that had happened previously at that same hotel on May 5th, 1980, just 17 days before Cottingham was arrested for attacking Leslie Odell.
So 17 days prior, he murdered somebody else?
Yes.
At that hotel.
At that hotel.
That is crazy.
Oh, it gets better. Just wait. Two bodies were found in that same hotel. A maid was cleaning a room, room 132, and she's like, I guess she's vacuuming, and she kind of feels it hit something under the bed, and she's like, what the hell? She lifts up the blanket, and there's a freaking body under the bed.
Wow.
And this was the same day that they found Leslie Odell?
No, this is 17 days before they found Leslie.
So three people.
No, this is the second one.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the second one. So Leslie Odell happened, and now they're looking at past murders, and they're like, wait a minute.
17 days before this,
this maid's cleaning the room and finds a dead body under the bed. She, of course, screams in horror because I could not imagine just doing your job and finding a freaking body underneath the bed.
That would be terrifying.
And you know, our oldest, anytime we stay at a hotel, she has a checklist. She pulls the blankets, makes sure there's no bugs. She checks under the bed, makes sure there's nothing in there. And then she goes to the closet to make sure there's nobody in there. It's almost like a routine for her. She checks all the spots. And now, I'm not going to bump what she's doing, okay?
And I feel so bad for the maid because I'm sure she's like thinking, holy, like I'm probably about to be a suspect.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah, just find a body. The body would be identified as Valerie Street, who was just 19 years old.
Wow.
She was known as a sex worker who had just been arrested recently, and she was charged with prostitution, like literally just a few weeks before she was found dead. She was naked. She had tape residue on her mouth, handcuffs around her wrist, and they also were able to find a fingerprint. I think on the cuffs, if I remember right, they were able to lift a fingerprint. They also realized that 3 years prior to Valerie Street's murder and Leslie Odell's attack in 1977, another homicide occurred at that Quality Inn. So okay, 3 years prior.
Why isn't this thing shut down? Like,
it's New York, though. How often it sounds bad, but how often are dead bodies found in New York?
I have no idea.
And this is the 1980s. So you have the drug epidemic, you have the sex workers, you have corruption in the police force, you have all of this stuff working. They don't have the databases like we do now to keep track of everything, where everything's happening. I mean, it's just everything stacked against them. Mary Ann Carr worked as an x-ray technician. She was absolutely, like, she was stunning. She was beautiful. All of these women were beautiful, don't get me wrong, but she was very pretty. She was a very pretty woman. She worked as an x-ray technician. She had a husband. She was a mom of, I believe, 2 kids. Am I remembering the right one? Maybe she wasn't the mom of 2 kids. There's another one on down where she was a mom of 2 kids, but she did have kids. Her husband was working out of town on a business trip, and he had tried calling the house a couple of times that day with no answer. You couldn't get an answer. Now I'm starting to question myself. I don't know. She was young and married. Maybe she didn't have kids. This one, I don't think it did have kids. Her husband was out of town on business. He tried calling several times that day to get a hold of Mary Ann, but she wasn't answering. After numerous attempts, of course, her husband's starting to worry. Why isn't she answering the phone? Why hasn't she been home yet? Why hasn't she called? So the police receive a call. While he's trying to locate her and see what's going on, the police receive a call about a body that was lying in the parking lot of the Quality Inn next to a fence. It was Mary Ann. She was still wearing her white uniform from work. She had ligature marks on her wrist, ankles, and feet. They noticed her uniform had tears in it, and it was determined that someone had sexually assaulted her and then redressed her before disposing of her body in the parking lot. It was also determined that she had been strangled to death. At the time, there was no connection made between Mary Ann Carr and Valerie Street, because again, Valerie Street was found inside the hotel room, and Mary Ann was found in the parking lot. So it's just far enough away to where they didn't make that connection.
Yeah. Not to be that person, but I feel like I probably would have made the connection.
You would think.
Like, it might have taken me a few
But it's days, 3 years, though. It's also 3 years. So who knows? You know, like I said, with the constant changeover in police departments and stuff, especially back then, it doesn't always get transferred over. And they don't have the database that we have now to where they can just search it and look it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot harder to keep track of everything. So no connection is made between these 3 attacks. Leslie, Valerie, and now Mary Ann. No connections made.
Okay.
Until now. Now that they realize that all of these attacks and murders happened in the same area, they're like, okay, now let's start comparing them, because they were very similar. They were all tied up. They were all sexually assaulted. Like, they all had very similar evidence, I guess.
Yeah. For some reason, I keep wanting to say M.O.
Yeah, well, it's his M.O. He has the same M.O. with all of his victims.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they do start connecting the dots. Richard Cottingham would not admit to being caught red-handed. He even stated the only reason he was caught was because the police didn't play fair.
What?
What? Excuse me? Come again? Yeah. He went on to say that he couldn't admit to anything because he couldn't remember. And if he started telling them about just one, that could open the door to many other killings. You just told on yourself, bro.
Yeah,
like, you
real.
Literally just said that. You did that.
Oh, my God.
He said that for every girl he killed, there were at least 10 that he let go. So gracious of you. So gracious of you to let 10 go compared to versus 1. Like, I just don't understand it.
This guy's a nut.
Insane. Like, absolutely insane.
It's almost like he's trying to justify what he did.
Yeah. Like, I might have killed one, but I let 10 of them go. Like, Okay, good for you. Why didn't you let all of them go? Why were you attacking them in the first place?
Why didn't you just go to a psych hospital?
He was willing to talk about the cases that he was convicted of, but he was refusing to talk about anything else. He's like, I'll talk about these, but I ain't talking about nothing else. He wanted to have the control, and he wasn't ready to let go of it. They were finally able to get a search warrant for his home and vehicles. In the house, there was a locked room in the basement. They asked his wife, Janet, about it, and she was like, that's his room. He keeps it under lock and key. I've never gone in there. I'm not allowed in there. That's his business. Like, I have no idea what's in there.
Okay, that's...
How that's do you have weird.
That's weird to me.
We're fixing to talk about her a little bit more, too. They were going through a divorce, so I think she was like, I'm done with you. I want nothing to do with you.
That makes a little bit more sense. But, like, it would be like if Josh had a room in the house and you're like,
bitch, I'm going in. I have
no idea what's in there.
I'm going in.
I never go in there. I'm not allowed in there.
Yeah, no freaking way. But I also think this is the 80s. Women were not treated like they are now, so they were kind of pushed to the side, and you obey your husband, and you sit quietly, and you do what you're told.
You make dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's still...
I'd be snooping while he was at work,
though. Girl, me too. I am too freaking nosy. You are not going to have a locked room and be like, don't touch it, don't look in it, don't go in
Even
there.
Even y'all safe, I walk past and I'm like, I want to look in there.
Guns. Lots of guns. Yeah, so that...
I definitely wouldn't be allowed to have a locked room.
No.
Audrey would get paranoid. She'd call me in the middle of the night.
I think there's a dead body in there.
Josh, just put a lock on a door in the house.
You're coming over. We're getting in. It reminds me of Maybe I shouldn't talk about that. So me and my best friend, Tamara... Anytime we would see a house for sale.
You're
going
to incriminate yourself. Don't do it.
Allegedly, we would want to see inside the house. And so we would just see if the window would open. And if it would, we may or may not have went in and looked. We didn't mess anything up. We just wanted to look inside the house.
Yeah. Charges are filed.
Yeah. We're in trouble. Sorry, Tamara. Sorry.
People are going to shut y'all's front door, like, so...
On October 15th at 9:24 a.m., all we can see is your butt hanging out of a window. It's all right. Well,
Allegedly.
This is all hypothetical.
Hypothetical. We just thought about it. We didn't do it, girl.
I was just thinking about it.
Well, Janet, which is his wife, and Cottingham, they were going through a divorce. She's like, we're going through a divorce. What he does is his problem. I'm just trying to get my kids and get the hell out of here. Like, I want nothing to do with him. I'm done. When they interviewed Cottingham about it, he would go on to admit to cheating on his wife on their honeymoon. Right from the get-go, cheating on his wife at the honeymoon.
That's crazy.
Why even get married? Like,
what? Yeah. You gotta have that mask.
One night?
You gotta have that mask of the perfect family and being a normal human being with a wife. And
so you could actually be a disgusting,
deplorable human being. Instead of Cunningham, his name needs to be Rottingham.
Wah, wah.
Wah, wah, wah.
Terrible joke.
Tori liked it. Tickled her a little bit. Yeah, so
we should so troll him in jail and just like color some rotten ham
and send it to him and be like, oh, it's fan mail. Oh, it's rotting ham.
You guys are crazy.
Oh, that's funny. Well, so yeah, he cheated on her during the honeymoon, and he said that once he did it, it was easy. Like, it was super easy for him. He's like, I never had trouble with the ladies. Okay.
Right. Okay.
Buddy. Sounds like all he was trouble for the ladies.
Exactly. He said that she was in the process of leaving him, and she was going to try to take the three kids from him when she left. So he got sloppy because of that, and he said that with his wife trying to divorce him and taking the kids, he got messed up mentally, and that's the only reason why he got sloppy and that he got caught. If it wasn't for his wife, he wouldn't got caught. They would have never caught him.
That's when he started struggling mentally?
This guy is a fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Lock him up for life. Give him the, like...
execution.
execute his brain cells.
Like, for a second there, when you were talking about how, like, it would make him have kind of weird mental things, at first I started thinking, you know, I can kind of sympathize with that. But the more you started talking, the less I sympathized.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, that's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, in reality, what he really couldn't stand is it was his wife taking control. He was no longer in control. His wife was taking it and saying, I'm taking the kids.
That probably really drove it even deeper of insanity whenever he no longer had control, mm-hmm. being that type of mentality.
Mm-hmm. And she's taking it away from him, which good for her. Take those kids and run, girl.
Yeah.
Run. In which, that's another thing, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. So when they're talking to him and trying to get him to confess, he does all of these awful, horrid things to these women, victim, one of them being a child. And he has three kids. And when they're trying to get him to confess this, he's like, I'm not confessing it because I'm trying to protect my kids. Who was protecting the other kids that you were murdering? They were somebody's child. What are you talking about? They were somebody's baby. They were somebody's mom, sister, aunt. Where was their protection? Like, it just does not make... I'm glad it doesn't make sense to me. I'm glad I don't think like a serial killer. But it does not... I can't comprehend it.
Well, it had to have been like a complete disconnect from reality.
Yeah. It's all about him. Again, it's me, 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 me. What are my needs? What are my wants? And insane. Okay.
Now you have me questioning myself because I can kind of see that in my mind.
See what?
The way he was thinking.
What? What do you mean?
Don't start buying locks, Josh.
Yeah.
Real suspicious.
No, like you were talking about how
he doesn't want to say what he's done to protect his kids.
Yeah, I mean
I can see that point of view,
but
you did this to somebody else's child.
So it's hypocritical.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and I get that.
And it's manipulation and just bringing the attention back on him.
Yes.
Like, I'm the good guy. I want to protect my kids.
But I'm this deplorable human being doing all this stuff. Yeah. It's insane. But I understand want to protect your kids and be like, I don't want to bring them shame or harm. I understand that. I don't fault him for that at all. But at the same time, on the other hand, you are doing this to other people's children.
Yeah, but I get that. But I'm just saying, like, I feel like... I don't know how to say what I'm trying to say. You're going to have to delete this whole segment.
Okay, we'll move on. We'll just take all that out. Okay, so where are we at now?
Josh, are you a serial killer?
I started thinking maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Well, let's go back to the locked room. What did they find in the locked room? They found money. They found porn magazines, women's jewelry, women's clothing. They also found books. You ready for the titles? Titles like Sex Victims, Stories of Surrender, The Prisoner of the Sheik, and it had a naked woman on the front, like in bondage. Tied Up Teasers with two women tied together. And The Boyfriend's Revenge. And on that one, it was a girl that looked like she was fixing to be attacked by two men. And why do these books exist?
why do these authors get to publish these books? The opposite
could be said for some of the things that are written for women, too.
I guess I do read some pretty smutty dark romance. I guess. But again, it goes back to, yeah, that's okay to read. Like, don't kink shame. If you got a kink, like, good for you. But then when you see it with a serial killer, then it's like,
okay,
that's weird. That's weird. Yeah, I get it.
That's why I'm a pro at kink shaming. I mean, if it's weird, it's weird. I'm going to call you out. Like, it's weird.
Yeah.
No knives, no guns. Okay.
You haven't read Lights Out yet, have you? Haunting of Adeline?
I already know.
You need to read Lights Out. Okay. If you want to add me on Goodreads, I have some good suggestions. I don't really read a lot of smutty, though. All the smutty books I've read, it's because Tamara's like, you need to read this. I read a lot of true crime, thriller, horror, some Colleen Hoover, of course. But literally all the smutty books I've read, it's because Tamara's like, you need to read this. And then I read it and I'm like, oh my God.
Like, what do you have me reading?
Yeah.
Hey, ghostly gang. The case is cold and the vibes are haunted.
We've got murder notes, EMF spikes, and no business being awake this late.
But thanks to W Energy Drink, we have clean energy with no crash, so we can hyperfixate on timelines, suspects, and whether or not the attic is haunted or a squirrel is hiding his nuts.
The flavors are criminally good. Like, we destroyed the evidence good. Not a drop could be found.
It's zero sugar, no artificial colors, and delivers terrifying levels of focus and mental clarity. Perfect for connecting red string and angering spirits.
Hit dubby.gg.com.
Use promo code GGP for 10% off.
Dubby, fueling guilty in the ghostly while the killer's still out there.
And the house is still haunted.
Okay, back to this guy. So now we're going to back it up from them arresting him and searching the room and finding all this stuff. 6 months before the three cases at the Quality Inn, December 2nd, 1979, at the Travel Inn Hotel in New York City, reports of a fire start coming in. They enter the room and they found a nude female. They drug her out to the hallway to begin giving her CPR, starting life-saving measures. But once they get her into the hall, they quickly realize she does not have a head.
Hey, I don't think there's any reviving that.
No.
Oh my gosh.
They enter the room again, and they discover a second body. Both bodies had their heads and hands cut off. To this day, their heads and hands have not been found. They had slice marks, puncture wounds, and bite marks so deep that it literally removed chunks of their skin from their body.
Damn.
You ready for another eerie...
Like dog bite marks or human?
Human bite marks.
So he was eating them?
No. He was just torturing them. Just biting them. Just inflicting pain in any way that he can. You ready for another interesting side fact? Interesting's not the right word, but creepy, spooky side fact. Someone bumped into Richard Cunningham as he was fleeing the scene of this. A gentleman by the name of Peter Vronsky was checking into the hotel at about 8:45 that morning, shortly before the fire was reported. Once he checked in, Peter was getting on an elevator as Cunningham was coming out. And I guess in the shuffle, Cunningham was carrying a big bag and it like hit the other guy in the shin. And the guy was like, I thought it was two bowling balls in the bag. It was their heads in the duffel bag.
Mm-mm. No.
He would later go on to say that he didn't think much of it at the time because, of course, he doesn't know there's two bodies missing their heads in the hotel room. And who's going to think he's got two heads in his freaking duffel bag?
Yeah, that's the last thing you're thinking.
And He would also say that as he was checking into the hotel, he said it almost smelled like burnt chicken feathers, I'm guessing from him starting the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Vronsky would actually go on to write a book called American Werewolf, The Life and Crimes of Serial Killer Richard Cunningham. So just put a pin in that. We're going to come back to that in part two. They would find out that the two women were held captive in that hotel room for 3 days.
Damn.
The police were determined to get the two ladies identified. They even removed the clothes from the victims that were that they were wearing and put them on mannequins, taking pictures of them and then posting that in the newspaper in hopes of finding out who they were. In doing so, their murderer, who had not yet been identified, would get the nickname the Torso Killer. After 2 months of circulating the pictures, someone was finally able to identify one of the victims as Dita Gordazzi. The other victim has never been identified to this day. They Wow. don't know who she is. Ready for another side note? There's all kinds of side quests on this one. Dita Gordazzi had a biological daughter that was given up for adoption at 10 weeks old. When she became an adult, she of course wanted to look into who her biological mother was, so she got all the information and found out, her daughter's name was Jennifer Wise at this point. Jennifer Wise, the daughter, would go on to establish a relationship with Richard Cunningham and even referred to him as Pops. She even thought that he might have been her father, and they actually did a DNA test to see, but he was not her father.
Thank God.
She continued visiting with him in the prison and worked with him in hopes to get him to confess to other unsolved murders. She even worked with Peter Vronsky as they continued to try and solve cold cases as well. And they even were trying to find the missing head and hands, and like were trying to get him to tell them where they were at. I stalked to Facebook, and she tragically passed away in 2003. It actually looks like she had to have an emergency brain surgery to remove a tumor, and they did one. I think the last search that they did was 1 month before she passed away, and she wasn't physically able to be there. She was still mentally coherent enough, so she was actually like on FaceTime with them as they searched the area that he had given them, but they still did not find the hands and body of her biological mother or the other woman. And then she passed away just a month later. So crazy. Well, just 4 months later, another body was found at the hotel. At the Hotel Seville in Times Square. There was a report of a room on fire. Inside the room was the body of a nude female. This time, no clothes were found. So I'm thinking he's watching the newspapers and sees, oh, they found the clothes and they're trying to identify them. I better take the clothes. The victim had ligature marks. Both breasts were cut off the body, and then the body was set on fire. Cunningham also placed both breasts on the headboard of the bed in the hotel room, almost showcasing what he did.
Crazy.
The victim would be identified as another sex worker named Jean Ann Rayner. In May of 1980, police began connecting all these cases in New York. They began broadening their search to see if Cunningham could be related to more cases and began working with Bergen County in New Jersey. Detectives then began going over all the evidence that they had against Cunningham to see if they could connect him to their open cases. And after reviewing the evidence from Cunningham's trophy room, they were able to connect him to more cases.
Wow.
They found Jeanne Rayner's necklace. She just so happened to be wearing it in a mugshot that was taken when she was arrested for prostitution just a few short weeks before her murder.
My gosh. So, like, do you think he just went on this spree all at once? Or do you think
It was through his entire life. They used the fingerprint that was lifted on Valerie Street. They used the fingerprint that was lifted off of Valerie Street, circumstantial evidence from Marianne Carr, and evidence and survivor testimony from Leslie Odell to charge Cunningham in all of those cases.
Wow.
He pled not guilty to all of them and would go to trial. Leslie Odell was hesitant to go on the stand, but like the badass woman she is, she did it. She would go on to tell the jury that he drugged her, tortured, and raped her, all while she's going into detail of all the awful things that Cunningham did to her. He just sat there completely emotionless, like a stone wall. He thought he was untouchable and that he was going to take the stand and talk his way out of it. Cunningham seemed to be very calm and matter-of-fact. He would say that it was a consensual, sadomasochistic sexual encounter. His mother and sister would be there every day of the trial, believing all the lies that Cunningham was spewing. They pleaded his innocence the entire time.
I mean, you have to want to believe that your loved one is telling the truth, especially in something as heinous as this.
Yeah, you just can't, you can't fathom them doing it. But then there's a line. There's a line.
If you have a witness and there's clear evidence,
yeah,
I'm turning my back on you. I'm sorry. Yeah. Like,
I'll be sitting on the victim's side.
It's so crazy to think that someone would do that, that you would almost believe them.
Yeah. I couldn't fathom. You just couldn't fathom it.
Yeah, your mind would completely shut down, especially with that kind of traumatic information.
Yep. Well, the jury met for about a day and a half, and he was found guilty and was sentenced to 75 years. It was then time to send him to trial for the murder of Jane Doe and Dita Gudarzi, because remember, they still haven't identified the other one, the two bodies that were found together in the burning hotel room. After the trial, he would be sentenced for a total of 5 life sentences between all the murders. Now we're going to fast forward to 2004. We're going back to Detective Robert Anzalotti. He's been trying every different method he can think of to try to get Cunningham to confess to the 12 cold cases that he had been working on from New Jersey. He tried the religious aspect, knowing that he was brought up a Catholic. He tried to appeal to the empathy side for the families. Nothing's working. Nothing was making him talk. He would go on and say, "You can't get me no more time. You can't give me the death penalty. I'm not leaving Trenton. There's nothing you can do to me. You can get me thrown in the hole again, but that doesn't make sense. You won't do that." He then goes on to say that he won't admit to anything else because of his kids. He didn't want them to read about anything in the papers. His kids were all adults by now and fully understand what he had already been convicted of. So they already know about all the other murders. Just give these families peace. Let them.
Yeah, seriously. They already know what kind of piece of shit you are.
Yeah, just let them. Let's see here. He began getting frustrated that he kept getting pulled for his meetings with Detective Robert Anzalotti. He said other prisoners began calling him a rat, and it wasn't a good look for him. Because the prisoners are like, "Are you ratting on us? Like, are you an informant? Like, what's going on?" This cracked me up. He said every time he got pulled, he had to walk by the Iceman's cell, and the Iceman would always chuckle at him because he knew exactly where he was going. Because the Iceman's in on it. He helped him.
Yeah.
I think that's funny. Karma. Karma's a bitch. They decided to start pulling him to take him to the Bergen County jail instead of the Trenton prison. They're like, "Okay, we'll work with you. So you don't get made fun of. We'll take you to this over here so you're not seen walking through the halls to come talk to us. We'll play good cop. We'll grant you that." He still wouldn't give them any information. Robert Anzalotti also tried to, like, appear friendly with him. They would go as far as playing poker with him after a day of questioning, just trying to build that rapport. Like, he said, "I'd get six detectives, and we'd all sit around playing poker with this guy." He goes, "It was awful. I hated every minute of it." But you have to play that role to appease them to try and get answers for these families. They would have to act like he was, you know, this okay human, just buddies playing cards. Another funny side note, so they flashed a picture up during the documentary, and how funny is this? It's not funny, but it's funny. So they have they would get him pizza or burgers, whatever he wanted to eat that night that they're interviewing him, they would go get it for him. And in the picture, they're all eaten. And in the middle of the table, there's two wine bottles. And I'm pretty sure it's the 19 wine and crime bottles like that we've got.
Oh, really?
On the table. Yeah. And I just thought that was kind of funny. This continued through 2006, and they finally started making progress. They finally came to an agreement, and whatever he admitted to that day would not be used against him in court. They're like, he's already in here for life. He can't be.
Yeah, there's nothing more we can do.
Nothing more we can do. So let's just try this angle. He finally admitted to killing a housewife in October of 1967. He met her while she was shopping. He remembers her having kids and that she was a really nice woman. They almost made like friends. He was stalking her, but she thought they would just bump into each other. And they almost made friends. Like, they were on friendly terms. He remembers her having kids. She was a nice woman. With the details that he gave them, they were able to link him to the murder of Nancy Vogel. 29-year-old married mother of two. Nancy didn't return home on October 28th after a day of shopping. Her family began searching for her, and after a couple of days, a couple of girls were walking home, glanced inside a car, thinking they saw a mannequin in the back seat. Nancy would be found on the floor in the back of the car, naked and tied up. The family of Nancy, this breaks my heart. The family of Nancy found out by a news reporter knocking on the door, and one of her, I think it was her daughter, answered the door. And before the kid could even say anything, the news reporter said, "Now that you know your mother's dead, how do you feel about that?" And that's how Nancy's family found out that she was found dead.
Wow.
That reporter should have lost their dog. Who said that?
Who said that? Nancy was raped, beaten, and strangled to death. Cunningham was never linked to the case until he gave them the details needed. They were able to determine that what he was saying was true when he told the detectives that she had two bags of groceries in the trunk of her car. And she did.
Wow.
He still refused to give a full confession of the murder, though. It was a constant back and forth with Cunningham, and finally, in 2010, the detective had enough of Cunningham and his demands. He told him, "I'm done. I'm not doing another damn thing for you until you give me something." Cunningham agreed to confess on record. The detective was asking for details, and Cunningham would say it was forced consensual sex. That's rape. That is rape.
Yeah. How exactly does that work?
He began talking about that day and what he did, speaking very calmly about the brutal rape and killing of Nancy, almost like it was just another Tuesday night. He was just very, "Well, I did this, and then we did this, and then I did this." Like, he was just very... It's creepy. It's very creepy. 6 years later, Detective Robert Anzalotti got the confession, and he was able to tell the family what actually happened to Nancy that night. But due to the deal they made with the devil, he did not want the media to find out because he didn't want his children finding out. So what they did is they went to the family and they said, "Look, we've got these answers, but we've got to keep it quiet. We will take him to trial." They made all these special arrangements so it didn't get caught. They did it like really late one day so that the media wouldn't know about it. They can't block the media from coming in, but they can schedule it when they're all off the clock. So that's what they did. They said basically the only ones that were in attendance were the detectives, the attorney, the prosecutor, and Nancy's family. That's all. So Cunningham agreed to accept another life term for his confession, but he would not go on trial unless everything would stay quiet. Again, he was saying, "I want to protect my kids. I want to protect my kids." So in August of 2010, he would go to a quiet sentence hearing for Nancy Vogel's murder. It was supposed to be short and sweet. He accepted the plea. They'd give him the sentence, be done, and get out of there as quickly as possible. However, The judge decided at the end of the hearing that he would go on to tell Cottingham about what a monster he was. He's a deplorable human being. He needs to dress coolly because he's going to hell to burn, by going on and on. And the detective's actually sitting behind Cottingham, and you can just see him like, oh shit, because it's supposed to be quiet, quick, get the hell out of here. And this judge is just going on and on and on. He's like, he's fixing to deny it. He's fixing to say, I'm done. I don't accept the plea. So you can literally see the detective like shrinking in on himself, like begging the judge, like, just shut the hell up and like, let's just get it done. He said that like he was sweating bullets thinking Cottingham's going to say, never mind, I don't agree to this. The judge even made Cottingham, which normally I'm like, hell yeah, brother. But the judge made Cottingham, he goes, you need to turn around to the Vogels and apologize for what you did. And Cottingham very calmly turned around and said, I apologize for the pain I put you guys through. I sincerely mean it. Turned around, faced the judge. Finally, the judge shut the hell up and finished it. He's sentenced, and Detective Ancelotti, he's going to start escorting Cottingham out of the courtroom. Cottingham stops, looks at Detective Robert Ancelotti, and mind you, he still has 11 more cases he's trying to solve. He's only solved one cold case. He has 11 more he's trying to get done. And this was just like the first big step. And Cottingham stops and he looks at him and he said, you will never get me to fucking do that again. And the detective's like, that is 6 years worth of progress that has just been blown by this judge because he couldn't keep his freaking mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
I have 11 more cases to solve and you just ruined everything.
So did the judge get fired for that? Or
no, judges can do what they want.
Yeah.
And that's where we're going to end part one.
Wow.
Holy.
To see somebody go through the evolution process of how he did and seemingly learned from his mistakes is fucking terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. Like practicing. It's like they're training and practicing to become better killers.
Yeah. What do you mean? Like with the clothes and everything?
Yeah.
A lot of people do.
Yeah.
That's why it's just media coverage, it's a hit or miss. Like it can really help the case at the end, but in the beginning, I don't think there should be any media coverage in the beginning.
And that's why a lot of detectives won't release everything to the media, because they don't want the information that they have to get out to the killer. Like, we found this, so we can use this lead.
Yeah, like, let's say
look at the Delphi murders.
Be on the lookout, and they're like, oh, it's a male, hair, long hair. He could just go and shave his head now.
But you have to be looking for him, and you can, I mean, I agree with that. I think the be on the lookouts are great, but I'm talking about, like, with these investigations saying he was wearing this type of shoe, this size of shoe, yada, yada. An average person's not going to look at your shoe and, like, you're 11 and a half, and you're da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
So keep that and just say tall, man, beard, tattoos, whatever. Yeah, let that go, but don't keep the little things that they can prove later on that they can't hide. So I just listened to Delphi Murders, a podcast on that. And they did kind of the same thing. You know, they had pictures and they had videos, but they weren't releasing everything because they wanted to keep it to try to find who did it. Sometimes it helps. Sometimes it hurts. But that's the gamble you take. So,
yeah. What an interesting case.
And I've started researching the second part. So once I go into the second part, it's going to be more of the cold cases and what transpires to try to solve those. It's not over yet. I'll just say that. It's not over yet. But I think you see more of the buildup like you were talking about.
Like the evolution process. Yeah,
you see it. So, again, this detective is amazing. The documentary is awesome. Lots of good information. It's dark. It's heavy. But you see actual videotape of him talking and during the confessions and during the interviews. There was one part I was telling Tori. So when they picked him up from Trenton to take him back to the county jail, they hadn't talked in a while. Oh, this might be in part two, but it's okay. I'll go ahead and tell it. They hadn't talked in a while, and they went and picked him up to take him to the county jail to interview him. And again, they're playing that good cop and talking to him. And he's like, yeah, did you miss me? And Cunningham's like, no. And he goes, aw, don't start that moody shit with me, man. Like, it's so funny watching them play it up, play that good cop. And he's like, it's hard. He said, it's really hard to sit across from somebody and act like you're their buddy and build them up. And just the stuff that they say just rips your heart out.
And you just want to. What they've done.
Yeah.
That's and crazy. Not knowing what more they've done.
Yeah. Yep. So we will continue part two next week. That's all I've got for this week. I've got to go get May to practice so she's not late and has to run. So until next week, stay spooky.
Stay warm. It's been cold outside.
And watch your evolution process.
Did you hear last week, though? We did the Fresno Nightcrawlers, and I was like, stay spooky, and he goes, and keep it on two legs, and I was like, what the hell? And he's like, because the Fresno Nightcrawlers. I was like, oh my God. All right, guys, we'll see y'all next week.
See y'all later.
Bye. Bye.